Hello and welcome to Euractiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And I'm Natasha Foote.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food team.
This week, unfair trade practices, a COP out, and a new chapter in EU-US agri relations. So hello and welcome back to the Euractiv Agri-Food Podcast. It has been a little while since we've been here, so I'm sure all of our loyal listeners really missed our voices last week. And that's because we had this special Capitals newsletter last week, and that was all on the state of play of organic agriculture across 12 different member states. So if you haven't seen that just yet, be sure to go and check it out.
But anyway, we're back to our usual scheduling now, and we are here to talk to you this week about the latest goings on in the EU agri-policy.
So this week, all eyes were on the COP26, and on the off chance you don't know what I'm talking about, the COP is basically this big event where world leaders fly in from all over the place to come and have a chin wag about how to reduce carbon emissions and tackle climate change. Obviously, with time running out for action on climate change, its organisers have called this meeting the world's best last chance to get runaway climate change under control. But what was interesting and what hasn't gone amiss this week is that the COP26 there was a distinct lack of agriculture in the COP26. That's not to say that people weren't talking about food at all, because apparently on the menu this week for world leaders was this plant-forward, sustainably sourced local UK products. Not sure exactly what that means for the world leaders, for what they were eating.
It's so clear, plant-forward.
Plant-forward. I mean, when I think of the UK, I'm thinking of pies, I'm thinking of baked beans. I can't imagine them chowing down on baked beans. I mean, that is plant, you know, plant forward. I don't know.
She's talking about her home country.
I mean, I think people have got that.
So,
do you think they ate Marmite? I know how you feel about Marmite.
Don't expose me. Don't expose me.
I hope they did try Marmite. I mean, it's an absolute... It's a delicacy.
Marmite. I mean, not all of our listeners know what Marmite is. It's like you said, delicacy.
Yeah, it's delicacy.
A food product that sold in the UK.
Yeah, and I smuggle a lot of jars every time.
Not that export. I mean, not super exported in the rest of the world.
I don't know
and
why.
That says a lot of things.
Everyone is missing an absolute trick here. Anyway, I've got like 7 jars in my cupboard in case anyone wants to try. But back to the COP. It was hosted in sunny Glasgow. That means they were chowing down on things like potato, leek, things like that. And there was also, actually, I thought it was quite interesting that menu items that people could choose from were also listed with their carbon footprint. There was someone that tweeted this week pointing out that a locally sourced bacon sarnie, which is another staple of British cuisine, actually accounted for less carbon emissions than a plant-based croissant. So
that's quite nationalist of Scottish people.
It's pushing an agenda there. But while sustainable food was clearly physically on the table, apparently it didn't move much from the plates. I mean, it wasn't tabled for actual discussion because the COP actually came under a lot of fire for neglecting to focus on agriculture as an emitter, but also as part of the solution to climate change. And also, not to mention, obviously, it's one of the sectors that, you know, stands most in the firing line of climate change. So not a single day of the 10-day schedule was dedicated to food and agriculture. It's not to say the topic didn't come up at all. In fact, US President Joe Biden did make the role of the agri-food sector in tackling climate change quite clear. And this is what he had to say in his opening address.
We don't just want to innovate in the industrial sector. The agricultural sector also has a vital role to play. As stewards of the land, our farmers belong on the front lines of the climate fight.
So what has been going on at the COP when it comes to agriculture? Well, we spoke with IEEP's head of the CAP and food programme, that's Harriet Bradley, who is actually there in Glasgow, to hear a little bit more.
So I'm at the COP, and what I've seen so far includes obviously the methane pledge, which is based on work spearheaded by the US and the EU that does include reductions in agricultural emissions, including but on the production and on the consumption side. But that has been quite absent from the coverage and the talk around the pledge.
Indeed, one of the first commitments from the national delegates and negotiator in Glasgow is this methane pledge to cut global methane emissions by at least 30% below 2020 levels by 2030. Sounds a bit like a farm to fork target, no?
Mm.
We are watching the farm to forkization of global commitments. So the initiative was led by the US and the EU, who gathered nearly 100 countries. I think the exact number is 105. And they all together account for 46% of methane emissions. Who's missing? I mean, who decided not to join this commitment? Well, a number of countries with high levels of methane emissions, such as China, India, Australia, and Russia. This a greenhouse gas, okay, short-lived, but it has more heat-trapping power than CO2. Like it traps 84 times more heat than carbon dioxide.
84 times?
Yeah, over a 20-year period.
Mm.
Yeah.
That is potent.
Quite potent, indeed. And why it's interesting, this pledge, because it's the first international political commitment taken on methane. Why it's interesting for agriculture? Well, agriculture is the biggest source of methane from human activity. We're talking about methane from enteric fermentation, basically burps from ruminant animals, primarily dairy and beef cattle. Okay, I said that. Now I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some cattle-rich countries in this pledge, like Brazil, Canada, Argentina, New Zealand, and of course the US and the EU countries who jointly initiated the pledge. At the same time, there was a bit of disappointment from environmental campaigners. I mean, they welcomed this pledge. It was the first time, as I said. But it's also true that the pledge focuses on technical measures, such as animal feed supplements. According to the United Nations, these animal feed supplements can cut emissions in the sector by 20% a year by 2030. But again, the pledge does not include behavioral measures such as shifting diets or tackling food waste, which according to several NGOs can deliver up to 60% cuts over the next few decades. So just a reminder, a few weeks ago, the Parliament called on the European Commission for a legislative proposal for binding targets on methane emissions as part of the measures to tackle climate change. And even in that case, was the first time that the Parliament or in the European Union was discussed a target for methane emission. But let's hear from Harriet what's on the menu again, other than the methane pledge when it comes to agriculture at the COP26.
And then there have been many side events on agriculture and food systems transformation. And these have been run by different actors, including FAO and also for the farm unions and other livestock organizations, for example. And the focus there is very much on efficiency improvements, so things such as feed additives, etc., to reduce methane. There's no talk, or there's an active shying away from talking about reducing consumption, and a real rejection of the need to shift to more plant-based diets, especially in wealthy countries. So the final thing is that on Saturday there will be the day on nature, and within that there are sessions on agriculture. So these are official presidency events, and there will be a lot of side events, but it is very surprising given the massive impact that the need for transforming food systems in order to keep within 1.5 degrees, that there's not specific negotiation negotiations dedicated to this topic, and that we definitely hope to see in the future.
Speaking of COP26, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has been quite criticized this week. There was a reporting from the British newspaper, The Telegraph, saying that she used a private jet for more than half of her official visit since taking office in December 2019. Mm. And these trips included a 50-kilometer journey between Vienna and Bratislava, and a trip that would take just over 1 hour by car or train. You know how we can call this scandal, Taj?
How can we call this scandal, Gerardo?
The Von der Flyen Gate.
Yeah. Amazing. You continue to amaze me.
Indeed. But what we're talking about this scandal in an agri-food podcast.
Good question. Well, so a journalist spoke about this during the midday briefing, one of the midday briefings this week. And Chief Commission spokesperson Eric Mamère, he was talking about the fact that he was talking about the stuff that the Commission was doing to reduce its personal carbon footprint, and also talking about the menu options when world leaders meet. And he actually slipped in the fact that President von der Leyen is actually vegetarian, which is kind of interesting. Apparently, this was actually public news, but I didn't know. Did you know this? I didn't know this, actually.
No. I didn't know about this. It's public because we actually made some research, and it was actually reported by other media past.
It's not brand new information, but it's kind of interesting. I thought it was interesting that he slipped this in when he was talking about this flying controversy.
There you go again, meeting. No, it's becoming a bit of not greenwashing stuff, but like, you know, you traveled a lot by plane this month. Hey, I don't eat meat.
Yeah, right.
It's becoming like a trend, no?
Offsetting your, what was it? A 50-kilometer flight.
Yeah.
Not eating a burger.
The moral personal ETS, the carbon system, but you know, in our daily life, you know, a way to offset the emissions.
Well, at least she's eating her veggies. And in other news, this week also saw the entry into force of the EU's groundbreaking Unfair Trade Practices Directive. And this was introduced back in 2019 and what was widely seen as a kind of David versus Goliath type fight between the food industry on one hand and the kind of the little guys on the other, aka small farmers and producers. So what is this all about? Well, the idea of the directive is to redress the imbalances in the EU food supply chain created by large operators against trading partners with weak bargaining power. So as I've already said, individual farmers and smallholders, and the idea is to try and protect these European farmers.
Basically, the aim is to try to put the power back into the hands of producers. So does this by banning certain unfair trading practices imposed unilaterally by one trading partner on another at the EU level in the agriculture and food supply chain. And this includes things like late payments, last-minute order cancellations for perishable food products, unilateral or retroactive changes to contracts, or refusal to commit to written contracts.
Now, EU countries were required to transpose the directive, which entered into force, by the way, on Sunday this week, of the 1st of November, into national law by the 1st of May 2021, and then apply it 6 months later. But the road to implementing this directive has been, I think it's fair to say, a fairly bumpy one. It actually resulted in the Commission opening infringement procedures against 12 member states back in July after they failed to transpose the EU rules within the allotted timeframe.
So where are the EU countries who have transposed the directive at? Well, according to the analysis of the European Commission, most EU countries that have reportedly successfully transposed the directive have actually chosen to go above and beyond the minimum protection set out in the UTP rules.
And they did this by extending the directive's list of unfair trade practices or kind of making their prohibitions stronger or stricter. And this has also prompted, you know, some stakeholders, industry stakeholders, to warn of some potential fragmentation in the single market. Saying, you know, if some are doing one thing and some are doing another, something stricter somewhere else, this could cause some problems. Other stakeholders took the opportunity to urge other member states to get a wiggle on, you know, just to speed up in transposing the directive into the national law. And actually, we spoke with the rapporteur on the UTP file, that's Paolo De Castro, who actually, I spoke to him on the sidelines of a real event. Can you believe it, Gerardo? There were real people there.
Yeah, it seems like from another world, actually.
It felt like from another lifetime, yeah. It was very exciting, But anyway, here's what he had to say.
To ask permission to come in agriculture committee,
yeah,
and to say what is the state of play in different member states, the application of the UTP's directive, and because the commission has just finished a study
on
60 member states, and then we have to analyze these results and try to, you know, push to have an harmonized application in all the member states,
mm-hmm,
and to push the member states who are late, like my country.
Yeah.
That's incredible, because I was rapporteur of the UTP.
Yeah.
We did everything before anybody, and now we are the last country. You know, that's, you know.
And have you had the chance to read the report that was released last week from the commission? You know, what your thoughts?
Yeah,
are you satisfied as a rapporteur to read this report? What was your thoughts on it?
We still have a lot of things to do to harmonize, because many member states is doing in a way. You know, you have France and Spain, who are a lot of advances if you compare with other member states, because they already have internal legislation before. And we have a lot of member states who are the first applications, like Germany or others.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are many different. But one of the key points that we stress during the debate on the variety of UTPs was to create a common ground, so the Commission have to take a look at all the member states to follow this step, and maybe member state who doesn't work in the right way to understand what is the reason, how, taking advantages of the experience of the other member state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this exchange view is very important. It was one of the points that we insist to introduce every 2 years. So I guess that was a very important result for the food chain. And I hope that, you know, we can go faster and in the right way.
Get everyone up to speed. Get Italy up to speed as well.
Yes, exactly.
And this week as well, there's a lot going on this week, actually. I've just kind of realised as we're listing it all here. But this week also marked an opening of a new chapter, as some are calling it, in EU-US relationships when it comes to agriculture. And what am I talking about here? Well, the US Agricultural Secretary, Tom Vilsack, actually came to Brussels this week. And together with EU Agricultural Commissioner Janusz Wojciechowski, the two of them announced the creation of a new transatlantic collaboration platform on agriculture. And this platform is designed to boost knowledge exchange between the two agricultural powerhouses and cooperation. And so the two were saying this is also going to promote mutual understanding and trust in efforts for the two of them to work together to address global challenges in terms of sustainability. And this is interesting because I think it's fair to say, wouldn't you say, Gerardo, that it's no secret that the US and the EU do not see eye to eye, maybe, on the future direction of the agri-food sector.
We can say that they have two completely different visions for the future of the sustainability of food systems, in the sense that the US is still hovering around the concept of productivity. So it's what happened a few weeks ago ahead of the UN food summit, where they basically launched this global coalition focused on productivity. And we know from reporting by the US specialized media that Vilsack in some press conferences have basically considered this new coalition as something to put in contraposition to the farm to fork strategy, which is the vision of the European Union, which is more focused on the concept of sustainability. Of course, food security always remain an important issue. It's actually, we can say that food security is actually in the treaties, in the EU treaties. It's an indirect link, but still there's a link. That's why it's interesting. And actually, Tash, you were there during this conference.
I was.
What's your take? What you perceive like from the atmosphere around the two?
I mean, it was clear that the two were here trying to kind of smooth over the cracks that we're talking about here. You know, there has been a lot of rising tensions about the EU sustainability ambitions. The two of them very much emphasize this idea of, you know, we have more similarities than differences. You know, we're working together. There was also this idea of, yes, we might have different paths, but the destination's the same. Like the goal is the same. You know, we're centered around a common sustainability goal. It's like the opposite of what everyone always says, you know, it's focusing on the destination, not the journey. So not how we get there, but that we're all going in the same direction. So that was the kind of the vibe, the idea. But
very, very philosophical. No?
Yeah, you're welcome.
A bit like the 80s, no? Yeah, we are the world people.
Yeah, exactly. Which is nice. There's a lot of nice narrative. They're talking about collaboration, cooperation, communication, all of this excellent. And obviously, you know, they also spoke about the fact that this has pretty much been the first real opportunity in almost a decade, they were saying, you know, with the Biden administration, for the respective ministries to work together in a partnership. So yeah, interesting. But it's true that beneath this kind of spirit of collaboration, shall we say, lay some veiled, or to be honest, not that veiled, warnings over future potential trade barriers and meddling in each other's affairs. So the US Agricultural Secretary, Tom Vilsack, was pretty clear that any attempts to impose external production standards on US agriculture would not be welcomed. You know, he was saying that if you impose production standards, there's going to be trade barriers. It will run afoul of the World Trade Organization. It's going to cause, take an economic toll. It will stifle development of new technologies. He was very clear that he was not going to stand for this, which is a problem because this external element of the farm to fork strategy, I mean, it's something that stakeholders are increasingly calling for. Farmers, you know, if they're upping their sustainability ambitions here, the question how they can be protected from imports that are created with lower standards, you know, this is the question we keep coming back to. And, you know, with stakeholders are basically pushing for the EU to apply the same high sustainability standards expected of European farmers to imported products. So I asked the commissioner about this. He basically said that he understood the concerns, but said it was very much not in the interest of either party to create barriers to trade. And he spoke about this, that this would be the main topic of discussion during the upcoming French presidency. It's also no secret that the French, French President Emmanuel Macron has previously said that there is a real need to rethink EU trade policies to include mirror clauses on climate and biodiversity. So I think it will be interesting to see how this goes.
At the same time, in France, there's this movement, this political movement who's pushing on this concept of food sovereignty.
Sovereignty, yeah, okay, yeah.
Mm. Which is a very, very French concept. It actually was conceived by a famous the sovereignty concept, Jean Baudin. But it's a bit conflicting, let's say. But still, it's always like this when it comes to you know, merging the trade ambitions and the sustainable agriculture ambition, because of course, I mean, sometimes they're a bit conflicting and there are a lot of conflicting overlaps, let's say.
So let's see how far the spirit of collaboration goes. So that's all from us this week. And this week, the Euractiv Agri-Food podcast was produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food news team. That's Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the technical support of our podcast producer, Evie Chiori. And you can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms. That includes Amazon, Apple, Spotify and Stitcher.
And be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening and see you next week.